The following program is a production of Sight into Sound Radio. Hello, and welcome to the eighth reading of The Nightingale by Kristen Hanna. I'm Anna McLean. Before we begin, let me explain that this book is read in its entirety. However, some of the reading may still contain explicit descriptions that some people may find objectionable. For those of you who did not hear the last reading of this book, let me bring you up to date. One day at school, Vian tries to intervene when a Gestapo agent and the local gendarme come to take another teacher away. The Gestapo tells her she is terminated. What will she do with no money and no job? Captain Beck assures her she will not starve this winter. Meanwhile, in Paris, Isabel has gone on several missions delivering packages. One night, on her way home, she finds an RAF pilot hiding in a garden and decides to help him. Now we continue with The Nightingale. She shut the door on him and shoved the armoire back into place, not quite where it went, but good enough for now. She had to get rid of his flight suit and tags before her father came home. She moved through the apartment on bare feet as quietly as possible. She had no idea if the people downstairs would notice the sound of the armoire being moved or too many people moving about up here. Better safe than sorry. She jammed the flight suit in an old Samartin department store bag and crushed it to her chest. Leaving the apartment felt dangerous suddenly. So did staying. She crept past the Leclerc apartment and then rushed down the stairs. Outside, she drew in a gulping breath. Now what? She couldn't throw this just anywhere. She didn't want someone else to get in trouble. For the first time, she was grateful for the city's blackout conditions. She slipped into the darkness on the sidewalk and all but disappeared. There were few Parisians out this close to curfew, and the Germans were too busy drinking French wine to glance outside. She drew in a deep breath, trying to calm down, to think. She was probably moments away from curfew, although that was hardly her biggest problem. Papa would be home soon. The river. She was only a few blocks away, and there were trees along the quay. She found a smaller barricaded side street and made her way to the river, past the row of military lorries parked along the street. She had never moved so slowly in her life, one step, one breath at a time. The last 50 feet between her and the banks of the Seine seemed to grow and expand with each step she took, and then again as she descended the stairs to the water. But at last she was there, standing beside the river. She heard boat lines creaking in the darkness, waves slapping their wooden hulls. Once again she thought she heard footsteps behind her. When she stilled, so did they. She waited for someone to come up behind her, for a voice demanding her papers. Nothing. She was imagining it. 1 minute passed, then another. She threw the bag into the black water and then hurled the identification tags in after it. The dark, swirling water swallowed the evidence instantly. Still, she felt shaky as she climbed the steps and crossed the street and headed for home. At her apartment door, she paused, finger-combing her sweat-dampened hair and pulling the damp cotton blouse from her breast. The one light was on, the chandelier. Her father sat hunched over the dining room table with paperwork spread out before him. He appeared haggard and too thin. She wondered suddenly how much he had been eating lately. In the weeks she'd been home, she had not once seen him have a meal. They ate, like they did everything else, separately. She had assumed that he ate German scraps at the high command. Now she wondered. "You're late," he said harshly. She noticed the brandy bottle on the table. It was half empty. Yesterday it had been full. How was it that he always found his brandy? The Germans wouldn't leave. She moved toward the table and put several franc notes down. Today was a good day. I see your friends at the High Command have given you more brandy. The Nazis do not give much away, he said. Indeed. So you have earned it? A noise sounded, something crashing to the hardwood floor, maybe. What was that? Her father said, looking up. Then came another sound, like a scraping of wood on wood. Someone is in this apartment, Papa said. Don't be absurd, Papa. He rose quickly from the table and left the room. Isabel rushed after him. Papa! Hush! He hissed. He moved down the entryway into the unlit part of the apartment. At the bombed chest near the front door, he picked up a candle and a brass holder and lit it. Surely you don't think someone has broken in, she said. He threw her a harsh, narrow-eyed look. I will not ask you to be silent again. Now hold your tongue. His breath smelled of brandy and cigarettes. But why? Shut up! He turned his back on her and moved down the narrow, slanted floor hallway toward the bedrooms. He passed the minuscule coat closet, nothing but coats inside, and followed the candle's quavering path into Vian's old room. It was empty but for the bed and nightstand and writing desk. Nothing was out of place in here. He got slowly to his knees and looked under the bed. Satisfied at last that the room was empty, he headed for Isabel's room. Could he hear the pounding of her heart? He checked her room, under the bed, behind the door, behind the floor-to-ceiling damask curtains that framed the blacked-out courtyard window. Isabel forced herself not to stare at the armoire. See, she said loudly, hoping that the airmen would hear the voices and sit still. No one is here, really, Papa. Working for the enemy is making you paranoid. He turned to her. In the corona of candlelight, his face looked haggard and worn. It wouldn't hurt you to be afraid, you know. Was that a threat? Of you, Papa, or of the Nazis? Are you paying no attention at all, Isabel? You should be afraid of everyone. Now, get out of my way. I need a drink. Chapter 18. Isabel lay in bed, listening. When she was sure her father was asleep, a drunken sleep, no doubt, she left her bed, went in search of her grandma's porcelain chamber pot, and holding it, stood in front of the armoire. Slowly, a half inch at a time, she moved it away from the wall, just enough to open the hidden door. Inside, it was dark and quiet. Only when she listened intently did she hear him breathing. Monsieur, she whispered. Hello, miss, came at her from the dark. She lit the oil lamp by her bed and carried it into the space. He was sitting against the wall with his legs stretched out. In the candlelight, he seemed softer somehow, younger. She handed him the chamber pot and saw that the color rose on his cheeks as he took it from her. Thank you. She sat down opposite him. I got rid of your identification tags and flight suit. Your boots will have to be cut down for you to wear. Here's a knife. Tomorrow morning, I will get you some of my father's clothes. I don't imagine they'll fit well. He nodded, saying, And what is your plan? That made her smile nervously. I'm not sure. You are a pilot? Lieutenant Torrance McLeish, RAF. My airplane went down over Reims. And you've been on your own since then, in your flight suit? Fortunately, my brother and I played hide-and-seek a lot when we were lads. You're not safe here. I gathered. He smiled and it changed his face, reminded her that he was really just a young man far from home. If it makes you feel better, I took 3 German airplanes down with me. You need to get back to Britain so you can get back to it. I can't agree more, but how? The whole coastline is behind barbed wire and patrolled by dogs. I can't exactly leave France by boat or air. I have some friends who are working on this. We will go see them tomorrow. You are very brave, he said softly. Or foolish, she said, unsure of which was more true. I have often heard I'm impetuous and unruly. I imagine I will hear it from my friends tomorrow. Well, miss, you won't hear anything but brave from me. The next morning, Isabel heard her father walk past her room. Moments later, she smelled coffee wafting her way, and then after that, the front door clicked shut. She left her room and went into her father's, which was a mess of clothes on the floor and an unmade bed, with an empty brandy bottle lying on its side on his writing desk. She pulled the blackout shade and peered past the empty balcony to the street below, where she saw her father emerge out onto the sidewalk. He had his black briefcase held close to his chest, as if his poetry actually mattered to anyone, and a black hat pulled low on his brow. Hunched like an overworked secretary, he headed for the metro. When he passed out of her view, she went to the armoire in his room and rummaged through it for old clothes. A shapeless turtleneck sweater with fraying sleeves, old corduroy pants, patch in the seat and bereft of several buttons, and a gray beret. Isabel cautiously moved the armoire and opened the door. The secret room smelled of sweat and piss, so much that she had to clamp her hand over her nose and mouth as she gagged. McLeish said sheepishly. Put these on. Wash up there at the pitcher and meet me in the salon. Put the armoire back. Move quietly. People are downstairs. They may know my father is gone and expect only one person to be walking around up here. Moments later, he stepped into the kitchen, dressed in her father's cast-offs. He looked like a fairy tale boy who'd sprouted overnight. The sweater strained across his broad chest, and the corduroy pants were too small to button at the waist. He was wearing the beret flat on the crown of his head, as if it were a yarmulke. This would never work. How would she get him across town in broad daylight? I can do this, he said. I'll follow along behind you. Trust me, miss. I've been walking about in a flight suit. This is easy. It was too late to back out now. She'd taken him in and hidden him. Now she needed to get him someplace safe. Walk at least a block behind me. If I stop, you stop. If I get pinched, you keep walking. Don't even look back. Pinched must mean arrested. She went to him, adjusted his beret, set it at a jaunty angle. Her gaze held his. Where are you from, Lieutenant McLeish? Ipswich, miss. You'll tell my parents, if necessary. It won't be necessary, Lieutenant. She drew in a deep breath. He had reminded her again of the risk that she'd undertaken to help him. The false papers in her handbag, identifying her as Juliette Gervais of Nice, baptized in Marseille, and a student at the Sorbonne, were the only protection she had if the worst happened. She went to the front door, opened it, and peered out. The landing was empty. She shoved him out, saying, Go, stand outside by the milliner's empty shop, then follow me. He stumbled out of the apartment, and she closed the door behind him. One, two, three. She counted silently, imagining trouble with every step. When she could stand it no more, she left the apartment and went down the stairs. All was quiet. She found him outside, standing where he'd been told to. She lifted her chin and walked past him without a glance. All the way to Saint-Germain, she walked briskly, never turning around, never looking back. Several times she heard the German soldiers yell out, Halt! And blow their whistles. Twice she heard gunshots, but she neither slowed nor looked. By the time she reached the red door at the apartment on Rue de Saint-Simon, she was sweating and a little lightheaded. She knocked four times in rapid succession. The door opened. Anouk appeared in the slit of an opening. Surprise widened her eyes. She opened the door and stepped back. What are you doing here? Behind her, several of the men Isabel had met before were seated around tables, with the maps set out in front of them, the pale blue lines illuminated by candlelight. Anouk started to shut the door. Isabel said, Leave it open. Tension followed her directive. She saw it sweep the room, change the expressions around her. At the table, Monsieur Levy began putting the maps away. Isabel glanced outside and saw McLeish coming up the walkway. He stepped into the apartment and she slammed the door shut behind him. No one spoke. Isabel had their full attention. This is Lieutenant Torrance McLeish of the RAF. Pilot, I found him hiding in the bushes near my apartment last night. And you brought him here? Anouk said, lighting a cigarette. He needs to get back to Britain, Isabel said. I thought... No, Anouk said. You did not. Levy sat back in his chair and pulled a Galois from his breast pocket and lit it up, studying the airmen. There are others that we know of in the city, and more who escaped from German prisons. We want to get them out, but the coasts and the airfields are sewn up tight. He took a long drag on the cigarette. The tip glowed and crackled and blackened. It is a problem we have been working on. I know, Isabel said. She felt the full weight of her responsibility. Had she acted rashly again? Were they disappointed in her? She didn't know. Should she have ignored McLeish? She was about to ask a question when she heard someone talking in another room. Frowning, she said, Who else is here? Others, Levy answered. Others are always here. No one of concern to you. We need a plan for the airmen, it is true, Anouk said. We believe we could get them out of Spain, Levy said, if we could get them into Spain. The Pyrenees, Anouk said. Isabella had seen the Pyrenees, so she understood Anouk's comment. The jagged peaks rose impossibly high into the clouds and were usually snow-covered or ringed in fog. Her mother had loved Biarritz. a small coastal town nearby, and twice in the good days long ago the family had vacationed there. The border with Spain is guarded by both German and Spanish patrols, Anouk said. The whole border? Isabel asked. Well, no, of course not. But where they are and where they aren't, who knows, Levy said. The mountains are smaller near Saint-Jean-de-Luz, Isabel pointed out. Oui, but so what? They are still impassable, and the few roads are guarded, Anouk said. My maman's best friend was a Basque, whose father was a goat herder. He crossed the mountains on foot all the time. We have had this idea. We even tried it once, Levy said. None of the party was heard from again. Getting past the German sentries at Saint-Jean-de-Luz is hard enough for one man, let alone several. And then there is the actual crossing of the mountains on foot. It is nearly impossible. Nearly impossible and impossible are not the same thing. If goat herders can cross the mountains, certainly airmen can do it, Isabel said. As she said it, an idea came to her. And a woman could move easily across the checkpoints, especially a young woman. No one would suspect a pretty girl. Anouk and Levy exchanged a look. I will do it, Isabel said, or try it anyway. I'll take this airman, and are there others? Monsieur Levy frowned. Obviously, this turn of events surprised him. Cigarette smoke clouded blue-gray between them. And you have climbed mountains before? I'm in good shape, was her answer. If they catch you, they'll imprison you, or kill you, he said quietly. Put your impetuousness aside for a moment and think on that, Isabel. This is not handing over a piece of paper. You have seen the signs posted all over town, the rewards offered for people who aid the enemy. Isabel nodded earnestly. Anouk sighed heavily, stabbing out her cigarette in the overflowing ashtray. She gazed at Isabel a long time, eyes narrowing. Then she walked to the open door behind the table. She pushed the door open a little and whistled, gave a trilling little bird call. Isabel frowned. She heard something in the other room, a chair pushing back from a table, footsteps. Gaetan stepped into the room. He was dressed shabbily in corduroy pants that were patched at the knees and ragged at the hem and a little too short, in a sweater that hung on his wiry frame, its collar pulled out of shape. His black hair, longer now, in need of cutting, had been slicked back from his face, which was sharper, almost wolf-like. He looked at her as if they were the only two in the room. In an instant, it was all undone. The feelings she discounted, tried to bury, to ignore, came flooding back. One look at him, and she could barely breathe. "You know, Kate," Anouk said. Isabel cleared her throat. She understood that he'd known she was here all along, that he'd chosen to stay away from her. For the first time since she'd joined this underground group, Isabel felt keenly young, apart. Had they all known about it? Had they laughed about her naivete behind her back? I do. So, Levy said after an uncomfortable pause, Isabel has a plan. Gaetan didn't smile. Does she? She wants to lead this airman and others across the Pyrenees on foot and get them into Spain, to the British consulate, I assume. Gaetan swore under his breath. We need to try something, Levy said. Do you truly understand the risk, Isabel? Anouk asked, coming forward. If you succeed, the Nazis will hear of it. They will hunt you down. There is a 10,000-franc reward for anyone who leads the Nazis to someone aiding airmen. Isabel had always simply reacted in her life. Someone left her behind. She followed. Someone told her she couldn't do something. She did it. Every barrier she turned into a gate. But this, she let fear give her a little shake, and she almost gave into it. Then she thought about the swastikas that flew from the Eiffel Tower, and Vianne living with the enemy, and Antoine lost in some prisoner of war camp. And Edith Cavell, certainly she'd been afraid sometimes, too. Isabel would not let fear stand in her way. The airmen were needed in Britain to drop more bombs on Germany. Isabel turned to the airmen. Are you a fit man, Lieutenant? She said in English. Could you keep up with a girl on a mountain crossing? I could, he said, especially one as pretty as you, miss. I wouldn't let you out of my sight. Isabel faced her compatriots. I'll take him to the consulate in San Sebastian. From there, it would be up to the Brits to get him home. Isabel saw the conversation that passed in silence around her, concerns and questions unvoiced, a decision reached in silence. Some risk simply had to be taken. Everyone in this room knew it. It will take weeks to plan, maybe longer, Levy said. He turned to Gaetan. We will need money immediately. You will speak to your contact? Gaetan nodded. He grabbed a black beret from the sideboard, putting it on. Isabel couldn't look away. She was angry at him. She knew that, felt it. But as he came toward her, that anger dried up and blew away like dust beneath the longing that mattered so much more. Their gazes met, held, and then he was past her, reaching for the doorknob, going outside. The door clicked shut behind him. So, Anouk said, the planning. We should begin. For 6 hours, Isabel sat at the table in the apartment on Rue de Saint-Simon. They brought in others from the network and gave them tasks to gather clothes for the pilots and stockpile supplies. They consulted maps and devised routes and began the long, uncertain process of setting up safe houses along the way. At some point, they began to see it as a reality instead of merely a bold and daring idea. It wasn't until Monsieur Levy mentioned the curfew that Isabel pushed back from the table. They tried to talk her into staying the night, but such a choice would make her father suspicious. Instead, she borrowed a heavy black peacoat from Anouk and put it on, grateful for the way it camouflaged her. The Boulevard Saint-Germain was eerily quiet, shutters closed tightly and blacked out, street lamps dark. She kept close to the buildings, grateful that the worn-down heels of her white Oxfords didn't clatter on the sidewalk. She crept past barricades and around groups of German soldiers patrolling the streets. She was almost home when she heard an engine growling. A German lorry shambled up the street behind her, its blue-painted headlights turned off. She pressed flat against the rough stone wall behind her, and the phantom lorry rolled past, grumbling in the darkness. Then everything was silent again. A bird whistled, a trilling song. Familiar. Isabel knew then that she'd been waiting for him, hoping. She straightened slowly, rose to her feet. Beside her, a potted plant released the scent of flowers. Isabel, Gaetan said. She could barely make out his features in the dark, but she could smell the pomade in his hair and the rough scent of his laundry soap and the cigarette he'd smoked some time ago. How did you know I was working with Paul? Who do you think recommended you? She frowned. Henri? And who told Henri about you? I had Didier following you from the beginning, watching over you. I knew you would find your way to us. He reached out, tucked the hair behind her ears, and the intimacy of the act left her parched with hope. She remembered saying, I love you, and shame and loss twisted her up inside. She didn't want to remember how he'd made her feel, how he'd fed her roasted rabbit by hand and carried her when she was too tired to walk, and showed her how much one kiss could matter. I'm sorry I hurt you, he said. Why did you? It doesn't matter now, he sighed. I should have stayed in that back room today. It's better not seeing you. Not for me, he smiled. You have a habit of saying whatever is on your mind, don't you, Isabel? Always. Why did you leave me? He touched her face with a gentleness that made her want to cry. It felt like a goodbye, that touch, and she knew goodbye. I wanted to forget you. She wanted to say something more, maybe kiss me, or don't go, or say I matter to you. But it was already too late. The moment, whatever it was past. He was stepping away from her, disappearing into the shadows. He said softly, be careful, Iz. And before she could answer, she knew he was gone. She felt his absence in her bones. She waited a moment more for her heartbeat to slow down and her emotions to stabilize. Then she headed for home. She had barely released the lock on her front door when she felt herself being yanked inside. The door slammed shut behind her. Where in the hell have you been? Her father's alcoholic breath washed over her, its sweetness a cloak over something dark, bitter, as if he'd been chewing aspirin. She tried to pull free, but he held her so close it was almost an embrace, his grasp on her wrist tight enough to leave a bruise. Then, as quickly as he'd grasped her, he let her go. She stumbled back, flailing for the light switch. When she flipped it, nothing happened. No more money for electricity, her father said. He lit an oil lamp, held it between them. In the wavering light, he looked to be sculpted of melting wax. His lined face sagged. His eyelids were puffy and a little blue. His paddle nose showed black pores the size of pinheads. Even with all of that, with as tired and old as he suddenly seemed, it was the look in his eyes that made her frown. Something was wrong. "Come with me," he said, his voice raspy and sharp, unrecognizable this time of night, without a slur. He led her down past the closet and around the corner to her room. Inside, he turned to look at her. Behind him, in the lamp's glow, she saw the moved armoire and the door to the secret room ajar. The smell of urine was strong. Thank God the airman was gone. Isabel shook her head, unable to speak. He sank to sit on the edge of her bed, bowing his head. "Christ, Isabel, you are a pain in the ass." She couldn't move or think. She glanced at the bedroom door, wondering if she could make it out of the apartment. "It was nothing, Papa. A boy. A date. We were kissing, Papa." "And do all of your dates piss in the closet? You must be very popular then," he sighed. "Enough of this charade." "Charade? You found an airman last night and hid him in the closet, and today you took him to Monsieur Levy." Isabel could not have heard correctly. "Pardon? You're a downed airman, the one who pissed in the closet and left dirty boot prints in the hallway. You took him to Monsieur Levy." "I do not know what you are talking about." "Good for you, Isabel." When he fell silent, she couldn't stand the suspense. "Papa? I know you came here as a courier for the Underground, and that you are working with Paul Levy's network." "How? Monsieur Levy is an old friend. In fact, when the Nazis invaded, he came to me and pulled me out of the bottle of brandy. That was all I cared about. He put me to work." Isabel felt so unsteady she couldn't stand. It was too intimate to sit by her father, so she sank slowly to the carpet. "I didn't want you involved in this, Isabel. That's why I sent you from Paris in the first place. I didn't want to put you at risk with my work. I should have known you'd find your own way to danger." "And all the other times you sent me away?" She wished instantly that she hadn't asked the question, but the moment she had the thought, it was given voice. "I am no good as a father. We both know that. At least, not since your maman's death." "How would we know? You never tried." "I tried. You just don't remember. Anyway, that is all water gone by now. We have bigger concerns." "Oui," she said. Her past felt upended somehow, off balance. She didn't know what to think or feel. Better to change the subject than to dwell on it. "I am planning something. I will be gone for a while." He looked down at her. "I know. I have spoken to Paul." He was silent for a long moment. "You know that your life changes right now. You will have to live underground, not here with me, not with anyone. You will not be able to spend more than a few nights in any one place. You will trust absolutely no one, and you will not be Isabel Rossignol at all anymore. You will be Juliette Gervais. The Nazis and the collaborators will always be searching for you, and if they find you..." Isabel nodded. A look passed between them. In it, Isabel felt a connection that had never existed before. "You know that prisoners of war receive some mercy. You can expect none." She nodded. "Can you do this, Isabel?" "I can do it, Papa." He nodded. "The name you are looking for is Micheline Babineau, your maman's friend in Urgne. Her husband was killed in the Great War. I think she would welcome you. And tell Paul I will need photographs immediately." "Photographs?" "Of the airmen." At her continued silence, he finally smiled. "Really, Isabel, have you not put the pieces together?" "But I forge papers, Isabel. That's why I work at the High Command. I began by writing the very tracts you distributed in Caravaux. But it turns out that the poet has a forger's hand. Who do you think gave you the name Juliette Gervais?" But you believed I collaborated with the enemy. I can hardly blame you." In him, suddenly, she saw someone foreign, a broken man where a cruel, careless man had always stood. She dared to rise up, to move toward him, to kneel in front of him. She stared up at him, feeling hot tears glaze her eyes. "Why did you push me and Vianne away?" "I hope you never know how fragile you are, Isabel." "I'm not fragile," she said. The smile he gave her was barely one at all. We are all fragile, Isabel. It's a thing we learn in war. Chapter 19. Warning. All males who come to the aid, either directly or indirectly, of the crews of enemy aircraft coming down in parachutes or having made a forced landing, help in their escape, hide them, or come to their aid in any fashion, will be shot on the spot. Women who render the same help will be sent to concentration camps in Germany. I guess I am lucky to be a woman, Isabel muttered to herself. How was it that the Germans hadn't noticed by now, October 1941, that France had become a country of women? Even as she said the words, she recognized the false bravado in them. She wanted to feel brave right now. Edith Cavell risking her life. But here, in this train station, patrolled by German soldiers, she was scared. There was no backing out now, no changing her mind. After months of planning and preparation, she and four airmen were ready to test the escape plan. On this cool October morning, her life would change. From the moment she boarded the train bound for Saint-Jean-de-Luz, she would no longer be Isabel Rossignol, the girl in the bookshop who lived on the Avenue de la Bourdonnais. From now on, she was Juliette Gervais, codename the Nightingale. Come, Anouk linked arms with Isabel and led her away from the warning sign and toward the ticket counter. They had gone over these preparations so many times, Isabel knew the plan well. There was only one flaw. All of their attempts to reach Madame Babineau had thus far failed. That one key component, finding a guide, Isabel would have to do on her own. Off to her left, waiting for her signal, Lieutenant McLeese stood dressed as a peasant. All he'd kept from his escape kit were two benzedrine tablets and a tiny compass that looked like a button and was pinned to his collar. He had been given false papers. Now he was a Flemish farm worker. He had an identity card and a work permit, but her father couldn't guarantee that the papers would pass close inspection. He had cut off the tops of his flight boots and shaved off his mustache. Isabel and Anouk had spent countless hours training him in proper behavior. They dressed him in a baggy coat and a worn, stained pair of work trousers. They'd bleached the nicotine stains from the first and second fingers of his right hand and taught him to smoke like a Frenchman, using his thumb and forefinger. He knew he was to look left before crossing the street, not right, and he was never to approach Isabel unless she approached him first. She had instructed him to play deaf and dumb and to read a newspaper while on the train, the entire trip. He was also to buy his own ticket and sit apart from Isabel. They all were. When they disembarked in Saint-Jean-de-Luz, the airmen were to walk a good distance behind her. Anouk turned to Isabel. "Are you ready?" her gaze asked. She nodded slowly. "Cousin Etienne will board the train in Poitiers, Uncle Emile in Ruffec, and Jean-Claude in Bordeaux. The other airmen, oui." Isabel was to disembark at Saint-Jean-de-Luz with the four airmen, two Brits and two Canadians, and cross the mountains into Spain. Once there, she was to send a telegram. "The Nightingale has sung," meant success. She kissed each of Anouk's cheeks, murmured au revoir, and then walked briskly over to the ticket window. "Saint-Jean-de-Luz," she said, and handed the attendant her money. Taking the ticket, she headed for Platform C. Not once did she look back, although she wanted to. The train whistle sounded. Isabel stepped aboard, taking a seat on the left side. More passengers filled in, took seats. Several German soldiers boarded the train, sitting across from her. McLeish was the last to board. He stepped into the train and shuffled past her without a glance, his shoulders hunched in an effort to appear smaller. As the doors eased shut, he settled into a seat at the other end of the compartment and immediately opened his newspaper. The train whistle blew again, and the giant wheels began to turn, picking up speed slowly. The compartment banged a little, heaved left and right, and then settled into a steady, thrumming movement, the wheels clackety-clacking on the iron tracks. The German soldier across from Isabel glanced down the compartment. His gaze settled on McLeish. He tapped his friend in the shoulder, and both men started to rise. Isabel leaned forward. Bonjour, she said with a smile. The soldiers immediately sat back down. Bonjour, mademoiselle, they said in unison. Your French is quite good, she lied. Beside her, a heavy-set woman in peasant clothes made a harumphing sound of disgust and whispered, You should be ashamed of yourself, in French. Isabel laughed prettily. Where are you going? She asked the soldiers. They would be on this carriage for hours. It would be good to keep their attention on her. Tours, one said, as the other said, Enzin. Ah, and do you know any card games to pass the time? I have a deck with me. Yes, yes, the younger one said. Isabel reached in her handbag for her playing cards. She was dealing a new hand and laughing when the next airman boarded the train and shuffled past the Germans. Later, when the conductor came through, she offered up her ticket. He took it and moved on. When he came to the airman, MacLeish did exactly as instructed. He handed over his ticket while he kept reading. The other airmen did the same. Isabel released her breath in a sigh of relief and leaned back in her seat. Isabel and the four airmen made it to Saint-Jean-de-Luz without incident. Twice they'd walked, separately, of course, past German checkpoints. The soldiers on guard had barely looked at the series of false papers saying Dankeschön without even looking up. They were not on the lookout for downed airmen and apparently hadn't considered a plan as bold as this. But now Isabel and the men were approaching the mountains. In the foothills, she went to a small park along the river and sat on a bench overlooking the water. The airmen arrived as planned, one by one. With MacLeish first, he sat down beside her. The others took seats within earshot. You have your signs? She asked. MacLeish withdrew a piece of paper from his shirt pocket. It read, Deaf and dumb, waiting for my maman to pick me up. The other airmen did the same. If a German soldier hassles any of you, you show him your papers and your sign. Do not speak. And I act stupid, which is easy for me, MacLeish grinned. Isabel was too anxious to smile. She shrugged off her canvas rucksack and handed it to MacLeish. In it were a few essentials, a bottle of wine, three plump pork sausages, two pairs of heavy woolen socks, and several apples. Sit where you can in your arms. Not together, of course. Keep your heads down and pretend to read your books. Don't look up until you hear me say, There you are, cousin. We've been looking all over for you. Understood? They all nodded. If I am not back by dawn, travel separately to Pau and go to the hotel I told you about. A woman named Elaine will help you. Be careful, MacLeish said. Taking a deep breath, she left them and walked to the main road. A mile or so later, as night began to fall, she crossed a rickety bridge. The road turned to dirt and narrowed into a cart track that climbed up, up, up into the verdant foothills. Moonlight came to her aid, illuminating hundreds of tiny white specks, goats. There were no cottages up this high, just animal sheds. At last she saw it, a two-storied, half-timbered house with a red roof that was exactly as her father had described. No wonder they had not been able to reach Madame Babineau. This cottage seemed designed to keep people away, as did the path up to it. Goats bleated at her appearance and bumped into one another nervously. Light shone through the haphazardly blacked-out windows, and smoke puffed cheerily from the chimney, scenting the air. At her knock, the heavy wooden door opened just enough to reveal a single eye and a mouth nearly hidden by a gray beard. "Bonsoir," Isabel said. She waited a moment for the old man to reply in kind, but he said nothing. "I am here to see Madame Babineau." "Why?" the man demanded. "Julianne Rosignol sent me." The old man made a clicking sound between his teeth and tongue. Then the door opened. The first thing Isabel noticed inside was the stew, simmering in a big black pot that hung from a hook in the giant stone-faced fireplace. A woman was seated at a huge, scarred trestle table in the back of the wide timber-beamed room. From where Isabel stood, it looked as if she were dressed in charcoal-colored rags. But when the old man lit an oil lamp, Isabel saw that the woman was dressed like a man, in rough breeches and a linen shirt, with a leather lace-up neckline. Her hair was the color of iron shavings, and she was smoking a cigarette. Still, Isabel recognized the woman, even though it had been 15 years. She remembered sitting on the beach at Saint-Jean-de-Luz, hearing the woman laugh. and Madame Babineau saying, "This little beauty will cause you endless trouble, Madeleine. The boys will someday swarm her," and Maman saying, "She is too smart to toss her life to boys, aren't you, my Isabel? Your shoes are caked with dirt. I've walked here from the train station at Saint-Jean-de-Luz." The woman used her booted foot to push out the chair across from her. "I am Micheline Babineau. Sit." "I know who you are," Isabel said. She added nothing. Information was dangerous these days. It was traded with care. "Do you?" "I'm Juliette Gervais." "Why do I care?" Isabel glanced nervously at the old man who watched her warily. She didn't like turning her back on him, but she had no choice. She sat down across from the woman. "You want a cigarette? It's a Galois Blue. They cost me 3 francs and a goat, but it's worth it." The woman took a long, sensual drag off of her cigarette and exhaled the distinctively scented blue smoke. "Why do I care about you? Julianne Rosignol believes I can trust you." Madame Babineau took another drag on the cigarette and then stubbed it out on the sole of her boot. She dropped the rest of it in her breast pocket. "He says his wife was close friends with you. You are godmother to his eldest daughter. He is the godfather to your youngest son." "Was. The Germans killed both of my sons at the front and my husband in the last war. He wrote letters to you recently. The post is shit these days. What does he want?" Here it was, the biggest flaw in this plan. If Madame Babineau was a collaborator, it was all over. Isabel had imagined this moment 1,000 times, planned it down to the pauses. She thought of ways to word things to protect herself. Now she saw the folly of all that, the uselessness. She simply had to dive in. "I left 4 downed pilots in Rouen waiting for me. I want to take them to the British consulate in Spain. We hope the British can get them back to England so they can fly more missions over Germany and drop more bombs." In the silence that followed, Isabel heard the beat of her heart, the tick of the mantel clock, the distant bleating of a goat. "And," Madame Babineau said at last, almost too softly to hear, "and I need a Basque guide to help me cross the Pyrenees. Julianne thought you could help me." For the first time, Isabel knew she had the woman's undivided attention. "Get Eduardo," Madame Babineau said to the old man, who jumped to do her bidding. The door banged shut so hard the ceiling rattled. The woman retrieved the half-smoked cigarette from her pocket and lit it up, inhaling and exhaling several times in silence as she studied Isabel. "What do you..." Isabel started to ask. The woman pressed a tobacco-stained finger to her lips. The door to the farmhouse crashed open and a man burst in. All Isabel could make out were broad shoulders, burlap, and the smell of alcohol. He grabbed her by the arm and lifted her out of the chair and threw her up against the rough-hewn wall. She gasped in pain and tried to get free, but he pinned her in place, wedged his knee roughly between her legs. "Do you know what the Germans do to people like you?" he whispered, his face so close to her she couldn't focus, couldn't see anything but black eyes and thick black lashes. He smelled of cigarettes and brandy. "Do you know how much they will pay us for you and your pilots?" Isabel turned her head to avoid his sour breath. "Where are these pilots of yours?" His fingers dug into the flesh of her upper arms. "Where are they?" "What pilots?" she gasped. "The pilots you are helping escape." What pilots? I don't know what you're talking about." He growled again and cracked her head against the wall. "You ask for our help to get pilots over the Pyrenees. Me, a woman, climb across the Pyrenees? You must be joking. I don't know what you're talking about." "Are you saying Madame Babineau is lying?" "I don't know Madame Babineau. I just stopped here to ask for directions. I'm lost." He smiled, revealing tobacco and wine-stained teeth. "Clever girl," he said, letting her go, "and not a bit weak in the knees." Madame Babineau stood. "Good for her." The man stepped back, giving her space. "I am Eduardo." He turned to the old woman. "The weather is good. Her will is strong. The men may sleep here tonight. Unless they are weaklings, I will take them tomorrow." "You'll take us," Isabel said, "to Spain?" Eduardo looked to Madame Babineau, who looked at Isabel. "It would be our great pleasure to help you, Juliette. Now, where are these pilots of yours?" In the middle of the night, Madame Babineau woke Isabel and led her into the farmhouse's kitchen, where a fire was already blazing in the hearth. "Coffee?" Isabel finger-combed her hair and tied a cotton scarf around her head. No, merci, it is too precious. The old woman gave her a smile. No one suspects a woman my age of anything. It makes me good at trading. Here, she offered Isabel a cracked porcelain mug full of steaming black coffee. Real coffee. Isabel wrapped her hands around the mug and breathed deeply of the familiar, never again to be taken for granted aroma. Madame Babineau sat down beside her. She looked into the woman's dark eyes and saw a compassion that reminded her of her maman. I am scared, Isabel admitted. It was the first time she had said this to anyone. As you should be, as we all must be. If something goes wrong, will you get word to Julien? He's still in Paris. If we don't make it, tell him the nightingale didn't fly. Madame Babineau nodded. As the women sat there, the airmen came into the room, one by one. It was middle of the night, and none looked like they had slept well. Still, the hour appointed for their departure was here. Madame Babineau set out a meal of bread and sweet lavender honey and creamy goat cheese. The men planted themselves on the mismatched chairs and scooted close to the table, talking all at once, devouring the food in an instant. The door banged open, bringing with it a rush of cold night air. Dried leaves scudded inside, dancing across the floor, plastering themselves like tiny black hands to the stones of the fireplace. The flames within shivered and thinned. The door slammed shut. Eduardo stood there, looking like a scruffy giant in the low-ceilinged room. He was a typical Basque, with broad shoulders and a face that seemed to have been carved in stone with a dull blade. The coat he wore was thin for the weather and patched in more places than it was whole. He handed Isabel a pair of Basque shoes called espadrilles, with rope soles that were supposedly good in the rough terrain. "How is the weather for this journey, Eduardo?" Madame Babineau asked. "Cold is coming. We must not tarry." He swung a ragged rucksack from his shoulder and dropped it on the ground. To the men, he said, "These are espadrilles. They will help you. Find a pair that fits." Isabel stood beside him, translating for the men. The men came forward obediently and squatted around the rucksack, pulling out shoes, passing them around. "None fit me," McLeese said. "Do what you can, madame," Babineau said. "Sadly, we are in a shoe shop." When the men had exchanged their flight boots for walking shoes, Eduardo had them stand in a line. He studied each man in turn, checking his clothing and his small pack. "Take everything out of your pockets and leave it here. The Spanish will arrest you for anything, and you do not want to escape the Germans, only to find yourself in a Spanish prison." He handed them each a goatskin bota bag full of wine and a walking stick that he'd made from knobby, mossy branches. When he was finished, he slapped them on the back, hard enough to send most of them stumbling forward. "Silence," Eduardo said. "Always." They left the cottage and filed onto the uneven terrain of the goat pasture outside. The sky was lit by a weak blue moon. "Night is our protection," Eduardo said. "Night and speed and quiet." He turned, stopped them with a raised hand. "Juliet will be at the back of the line. I will be at the front. When I walk, you walk. You walk in single file. There is no talking. None. You will be cold, freezing cold on this night, and hungry, and soon you will be tired. Keep walking." Eduardo turned his back on the men and began walking up the hill. Isabel felt the cold instantly. It bit into her exposed cheeks and slipped through the seams of her woolen coat. She used her gloved hand to hold the pieces of her collar together and began the long trek up the grassy hillside. Sometime around 3 a.m, the walk became a hike. The terrain steepened. The moon slid behind invisible clouds and blinked out, leaving them in near total darkness. Isabel heard the men's breathing become labored in front of her. She knew they were cold. Most of them did not have adequate clothing for this freezing air, and few of them had shoes that fit correctly. Twigs snapped beneath their feet. Rocks clattered away from them, made a sound like rain on a tin roof as they fell down the steep mountainside. The first pangs of hunger twisted her empty stomach. It started to rain. A gnashing wind swept up from the valley below, slamming into the party walking single file. It turned the rain into freezing shards that attacked their exposed skin. Isabel began to shiver uncontrollably. Her breath came out in great, heaving gasps, and still she climbed, up, 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 past the tree line. Ahead, someone made a yelping sound and fell hard. Isabel couldn't see who it was. The night had closed around them. The man in front of her stopped. She ran into his back, and he stumbled sideways, fell into a boulder, and cursed. "Don't stop, men," Isabel said, trying to keep the spirit in her voice. They climbed until Isabel gasped with every step, but Eduardo allowed them no respite. He stopped only long enough to make sure they were still behind him, and then he was off again, clambering up the rocky hillside like a goat. Isabel's legs were on fire, aching painfully, and even with her espadrilles, blisters formed. Every step became an agony and a test of will. Hours and hours and hours passed. Isabel grew so breathless she couldn't have formed the words needed to beg for a drink of water, but she knew that Eduardo wouldn't have listened to her anyway. She heard McLeish in front of her, gasping, cursing every time he slipped, crying out in pain at the blisters she knew were turning his feet into open sores. She couldn't make out the path at all anymore. She just trudged upward, her eyelids struggling to stay open. Angling forward against the wind, she pulled her scarf up over her nose and mouth and kept going. Her breath, coming in pants, warmed her scarf. The fabric turned moist and then froze into solid, icy folds. "Here," Eduardo's booming voice came at her from the darkness. They were so high up the mountain that there were sure to be no German or Spanish patrols. The risk to their lives up here came from the elements. Isabel collapsed in a heap, landing hard enough on a piece of rock that she cried out, but she was too tired to care. McLeish dropped down beside her, gasping, "Christ almighty," and pitching forward. She grabbed his arm, steadied him as he started to slide downward. She heard a cacophony of voices come after it. "Thank God! Bloody well time!" And then she heard bodies hit the ground. They fell downward in a group, as if their legs could hold them no more. "Not here," Eduardo said. "The goat herder's shack, over there." Isabel staggered to her feet. In the back of the line she waited, shivering, her arms crossed around her body as if she could hold heat within. But there was no heat. She felt like a shard of ice, brittle and frozen. Her mind fought the stupor that wanted to take over. She had to keep shaking her head to keep her thoughts clear. She heard a footstep and knew Eduardo was standing beside her in the darkness, their faces pelted by icy rain. "Are you all right?" he asked. "I'm frozen solid, and I'm afraid to look at my feet. Blistered? The size of dinner plates, I'm pretty sure. I can't tell if the rain is making my shoes wet or if blood is bubbling through the material." She felt tears sting her eyes and freeze instantly, binding her lashes together. Eduardo took her hand and led her to the goatherder's shed, where he started a fire. The ice in her hair turned to water and dripped to the floor, puddling at her feet. She watched the men collapse where they stood, thumping back against the rough wooden walls as they pulled their rucksacks into their laps and began searching through them for food. McLeish waved her over. Isabel picked her way through the men and collapsed beside McLeish. In silence, listening to men chewing and belching and sighing around her, she ate the cheese and apples she'd brought with her. She had no idea when she fell asleep. One minute she was awake, eating what passed for supper on the mountain, and the next thing she knew, Eduardo was waking them again. Gray light pressed against the dirty window of the shack. They'd slept through the day and been wakened in the late afternoon. Eduardo started a fire, made a pot of ersatz coffee, and handed it out to them. Breakfast was stale bread and hard cheese, good, but not nearly enough to stave off the hunger that was still sharp from yesterday. Eduardo took off at a brisk walk, climbing the slick, frost-covered shale of the treacherous trail like a billy goat. Isabel was the last one out of the shack. She looked up the trail. Gray clouds obscured the peaks and snowflakes hushed the world until there was no earthly sound except their breathing. Men vanished in front of her, becoming small black dots in the whiteness. She plunged into the cold, climbing steadily, following the man in front of her. He was all she could see in the falling snow. Eduardo's pace was punishing. He climbed up the twisting path without pause, seemingly unaware of the biting, burning cold that turned every breath into a fire that exploded in the lungs. Isabel panted and kept going, encouraging the men when they started to lag, cajoling them and teasing them and urging them on. When darkness fell again, she redoubled her efforts to keep morale up. Even though she felt sick to her stomach with fatigue and parched with thirst, she kept going. If any one of them got more than a few feet away from the person in front of him, he could be lost forever in this frozen darkness. To leave the path for a few feet was to die. She stumbled on through the night. We have come to the end of the book hour in today's reading of The Nightingale by Kristen Hannah. The preceding program was a production of Sight into Sound Radio.